From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Democrats continue pushing to close the gender pay gap and raise the minimum wage. We talk with Senator Debbie Stabenow.
The truth is, when people have money in their pocket, it helps business because more people can buy things and take their family out to eat and, you know, put gas in the car.
The Detroit Red Wings are getting a new home. Will it pay off for taxpayers?
Study after study shows that that phrase that gets thrown around a lot, economic impact, just isn't there because all the revenues lie in the owner's pockets.
And embracing a mixed race background.
3.3% of our students now self-identify as mixed race. And my question for myself and for our university community was, what does that mean?
Those stories and much more today. A new $450 million hockey arena is on its way for the Detroit Red Wings, and 60% will be paid for by taxpayers. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, will that public investment pay off, and what lessons can be learned from similar deals around the nation? Then, when talking about diversity on college campuses, are we counting mixed-race students? That story in 15 minutes. But first, raising the federal minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $10.10 an hour and closing the pay gap between men and women. These are key parts of the 2014 midterm election campaign for Democrats. President Obama's trip to Ann Arbor last week focused on the minimum wage issue, as we know, and he had this to say at the National Equal Pay Day event at the White House yesterday.
And I don't care whether you're Democrat or Republican, if you're a voter, if you've got a daughter, you got a sister, you got a mom, I know you got a mom, this is something you should care about.
And as Democrats speak of poverty and the struggles of minimum wage workers, Republicans speak about jobs, losing jobs, and point to a Congressional Budget Office report that found increasing the minimum wage could cost the country hundreds of thousands of jobs. So is there room for compromise? Is there common ground? Well, we find out now as we welcome Senator Debbie Stabenow back to Stateside. Good to have you, Senator.
Well, it's good to be with you, as always.
And let's start with the minimum wage. I have to say, it would seem just as strongly as Democrats feel that $10.10 an hour should be the federal minimum wage, there are Republicans who feel just as strongly that if that happens, employers are going to have to lay people off and cut jobs. Is there somewhere to meet in the middle?
Well, first of all, I think we have to have the basic principle that if you're working 40 hours a week, and that you're not in poverty. And then secondly, the other side of that, which is really important to remember, is the average CEO right now makes the same amount of money as 933 minimum wage workers. So this doesn't work if we're going to have an economy and a middle class and people being able to afford to buy things. And, you know, I would say we have a perfect example of how the argument that businesses are making is really not true, and that's with Henry Ford. When he doubled the wages of his employees 100 years ago in 1914, went to $5 a day, all the businesses at Wall Street said it was economic insanity. And yet, if you go back and read the Detroit papers at that time, not only did people have more money in their pocket to care for their families, but all the little businesses around the plant started talking about how they were selling more. So the truth is, when people have money in their pocket, it helps business because more people can buy things and take the family out to eat and, you know, put gas in the car.
But before that happens, somebody has to cough up that higher pay. And I guess I'm wondering how you would answer business owners here in Michigan who are still recovering from this, you know, terrible recession, who say their costs have already had to go up to meet the Affordable Care Act and that they can't handle $10.10 an hour. Is there room for some kind of adjustment or compromise on that?
Well, I think the key, again, 10-10 just hits the number where people aren't in poverty anymore. And so we certainly support these small businesses, and a lot of small businesses actually are getting a better opportunity right now to buy lower cost insurance, which is a good thing, and tax credits to help buy insurance. And we are seeing what happens as things recover and more people can go to local retailers and go out to eat in restaurants and do things that grow the economy. But if we are below the poverty line for work, then all of us as taxpayers are paying for food assistance, federal food assistance, you know, the big debate in the Farm Bill about food assistance. Well, if people who are working full-time are below the poverty line, then we as taxpayers are supplementing them, when instead what we ought to be doing is making reward work pay. Work should pay. If you're working, you know, you ought to be above the poverty line and be able to care for your family.
I'm speaking with Michigan's Senator Debbie Stabenow, and we want to move now over to the Paycheck Fairness Act aimed at correcting the pay gap. You're one of 55 co-sponsors. A new study from the National Partnership for Women and Families finds that here in Michigan, women are making 74 cents for every dollar men earn, although we should note that some have disputed the exact numbers. But whatever the case, it's certainly an issue here in Michigan, and the report claims we have the seventh largest gender-based pay gap in the nation.
We absolutely do. And, you know, the last time I looked, when I went to the grocery store, or when my friends or family go to the grocery store, they don't get a discount on their food if they're women. you don't get a 26% discount on gasoline. I mean, that would be a fair deal. But the truth of the matter is, we are seeing way too many women. I had a woman write to me who said that from Wayne County area, who said that her boss actually bragged that he liked to hire women because he could pay them less. Well, you know, their costs aren't less. I mean, that makes no sense. It's not fair in this day and age. You think that because we have equal pay laws on the books, that would be enough. Problem is, people don't know what they're getting paid. Oftentimes, they can be fired if they share that information. So what we're talking about is making this open and transparent so people know in the workplace what they're getting paid. We had a woman from Houghton, Michigan, very powerful testimony, come into the Senate. She's an engineer. She found out after her business closed down the road when they were revealing salaries that she was paid less than every one of the men she supervised. And she didn't know that because there'd been no way to find out that information.
Now, this Paycheck Fairness Act has no Republican co-sponsors, if I'm correct, and they've blocked it from going forward, but it came up from a vote in 2012, because Republicans say, well, it's already illegal to discriminate by sex, so this bill is just piling on. To that, you say?
Well, it's like the president said, it's not about myth, it's about math. So the numbers speak for themselves. Obviously, the law's not working when a woman can be fired for just trying to find out how she stacks up in her pay with the men that she works with. And so we need laws that actually work, where people aren't penalized. And again, it's just fair. I mean, it's really unfortunate that folks are playing politics with this, or saying that somehow it's nonsense or frivolous to talk about whether or not women get the pay that they deserve when they're working. I would hope in 2014 we wouldn't be even having this debate.
Spell out for us exactly what the bill would do, just so we really understand what's at stake
here.
Well,
it basically gives the tools for women to be able to find out information about how much they are paid, to really have transparency in the workplace, to be able to ask questions, to be able to know what the situation is, because the law is there that for you to take action if you're not paid equally, but there's no way to find out. And right now people are penalized for trying to find out, and that's where the problem is.
Senator Debbie Stabenow, thank you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you. Take care.
And in the time since we spoke with Senator Stabenow, the Paycheck Fairness Act did come up for a Senate vote, and there were not enough votes to end GOP blocking tactics against the bill, so it has failed for a third straight year. Democrats still hope this effort will help drive up voter turnout this fall by women who historically lean more Democratic than men. Well, think about this for a second. How are we doing as a nation, as a state, in our election performance? The Pew Charitable Trust's latest Elections Performance Index looked at all 50 states and the District of Columbia and measured how well they conducted their elections. Let's see how Michigan fared as we welcome Sean Green. He's a research manager for the Pew Charitable Trust. So good to have you with us, Sean.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Before we hear how Michigan scored in the EPI, give us an idea of the indicators that are used.
Sure. I'll give you an example of a few. There are 17 indicators that are used to make up our index. Some examples are, does a state have online voter registration available for its voters? Voter turnout, wait times at the polls, how long people are waiting at the polls, things related to militant overseas ballots being not returned or rejected. So different parts of the election process like that.
So from 2008's election to 2012's, how did Michigan fare?
So Michigan did great. In fact, Michigan is only one of seven states that's been a top performer, sort of in the top 12 of states over the past 3 years, 2008, 2010, and 2012. And specifically, Michigan's score went from 72% in 2008, a ranked number seven, to 76% in 2012, a ranked number six. So they've been a high and steady performer since we started this index.
What were some of the strong elements of Michigan's election performance?
One of the things is that there's a really pretty strong voter registration system in Michigan. So as a result of that, there's hardly any provisional ballots that are cast or rejected, because a lot of problems related to why you need to issue a provisional ballot are related to voter registration problems. Additionally, the state also had decreased its number of militant overseas ballots rejected. And also, in between the two election cycles, added a post-election audit to help better evaluate voting technology after elections take place.
But there is room for improvement, especially in something called the residual vote rate. Can you explain what that is and what's happening with that in Michigan?
Sure. The residual vote rate is something where it's how many ballots essentially are not counted out of all ballots cast due to either a voter checking off too many boxes, say, for example, or leaving it blank. So some people, of course, leave that blank intentionally. But we found, you know, Michigan's residual vote rate is a little higher than the average, but it's actually just one of the few indicators they don't do very well on. I'd say another one that there's probably room for improvement in Michigan is voting wait times. Michigan had a wait of about 22 minutes in 2012, which is similar to that of 2008, which is above the national average.
And what does it take to do that? It's not a matter of spending money as much, is it?
No, and this is one of those things where it's not a one-size-fits-all problem at all. It depends on the state, and sometimes it even depends on the county or locality. There can be very specific things to how long is the ballot, to other issues like how a polling place is set up. So there's a lot of factors that go in. I think it takes, you know, the state and localities sort of looking back and seeing maybe what some of the issues were and trying to figure what they were that were specific to them.
All right. Well, good talking with you. Thank you so much for the insight. Sean Green is with the Pew Charitable Trust as we talk about their latest Elections Performance Index. Thanks, Sean.
Great. Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When it comes to diversity, who really counts? That's the challenging question raised by my next guest in a piece she wrote for the Huffington Post. It was born out of some important insights that dawned on her as she stood in front of her class and really listened to her students. She's a professor of history, law, Afro-American, and African studies at the University of Michigan. Martha S. Jones, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you had a real aha moment in the winter of 2010 as you were meeting the students in your seminar. What were they saying that really hit you?
What really hit me is that they were so open to talking about identity. And in particular, when we talked about the subject of race, marriage, and history in the United States, they were eager to talk about their own family histories, their own family experiences, and specifically to identify themselves as mixed race people.
And that hit you because of your own history.
Exactly. What I explained is that I, too, came from a mixed race family, but as you can imagine, I'm a generation before my students.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, in my experience, being mixed race wasn't an option. It wasn't part of our vocabulary. It wasn't part of our cultural experience. I was raised, if you will, pursuant to a one-drop rule, which is to say a point of view that suggested that anyone who was in any way descended from people of African descent, then you were black in the United States, and that's the way I was raised.
So what did this personal epiphany do in the way that you thought about yourself and the way you thought of the student sitting in front of you?
Well, it reminded me something that I often explain to my students, that ideas about race change over time and across generations, and that what I was seeing in front of me was a generation of students who had been born subsequent to the United States Supreme Court decision in Loving versus Virginia, which is to say subsequent to the striking down of anti-miscegenation laws in the United States, and that they had a set of possibilities about identity that I had not enjoyed. My one-drop rule had become their mixed-race identity.
And it really hammered home how what is real in 2014 is certainly not what was real, let's say, in 1964.
That is correct. That is correct. And we're still grappling with the implications of that shift, I think.
Tell me about that. What kind of implications does that offer?
Well, the question that I asked recently is, what does it mean that we now count, if you will, mixed-race Americans? On the United States Census since the year 2000, we are all offered the opportunity to check more than one box when we self-identify vis-a-vis race. In 2010, more than 9 million Americans responded by checking more than one box. At the University of Michigan, since 2010, we've given our students the same sort of option when they self-identify in terms of race. And we learn that 3.3% of our students, a significant number of our students, now self-identify as mixed race. And my question for myself and for our university community was, what does that mean?
Yeah.
In terms of diversity.
And what do you think that does mean? Because at the same time that you tell us this, there's certainly been a lot of conversation on Michigan's campus this school year about the declining enrollment numbers of black students. I think I see 7.8% in 2004 to 4.8% this year. But then you also see this 3.3% self-identifying as mixed race. How does that all fit, do you think?
Well, I have to say first that I was very inspired by the hashtag campaign and the student activism that has followed that, the BBUM or Being Black at the University of Michigan campaign that our students have undertaken during this year. That has been exciting and important and has really generated a new sort of attention to the question of diversity at Michigan. I was also inspired by work we did during the last academic year with NPR's Michelle Norris, who you may know, came to Ann Arbor in 2012 and 2013 with her Race Card Project. And in that project, Michelle invited members of the University of Michigan community to, in six words, capture some essence of their thoughts about race. And one of the things that I think I did not anticipate when we began that project was how many people would, in fact, when they reflected on race, talk about the mixed race experience.
In fact, Michelle Norris has even said herself on NPR that this issue of mixed race has come up the most during the Race Card Project.
I get a lot of submissions around a dilemma involving the exercise of checking a box to determine your racial identity.
I like the way in your Huffington Post piece you wrote that mixed race students navigate a world that is often still organized around boxes of racial certitude. What price do you think we pay for those boxes of racial certitude?
Well, I think one of the prices that we pay is silence, that when people don't see themselves as reflected in our census questionnaire or in our university statistics or in the way we organize student organizations and campus life, I think the first price we pay is silence. And that's why the work on the Race Card Project was so important for us, because it brought to light voices that I think we had overlooked by and large on our campus. So today, I think part of what my suggestion is we start by listening, and that we create the kind of spaces and the kinds of conversations that give mixed race students the opportunity to really teach us what it means to be a mixed race person, how that shapes their experience on our campus, but in the world, and how that is perhaps a part of our story of diversity, and which is a value that we very much honor at the University of Michigan.
And really for a large national conversation for schools and universities, it's important for them to say we have a diverse student body. But as you point out, at so many schools, mixed race students aren't being counted. So it is a big missed opportunity for these schools, isn't it?
Well, I think it is. And, you know, one of the things that, Cynthia, that I've encountered in the many, many comments that I've gotten on these pieces is a concern that somehow mixed race people are playing two sides of the street or using race as a card when it's convenient. And I want to say to those skeptics or those critics, well, then let's do the work and study that, because I don't think there's any empirical evidence that suggests that somehow mixed race identity is a dishonest or a strategic move on the part of our students, for example. But we need to do the empirical work to understand better how it is that mixed race people are self-identifying, how they fit in to a campus that is still organized around a kind of racial certitude. And we need to learn more. We need to get better at doing the work we already do very well.
And some of this is just going to take time, isn't it? Because as you point out, it wasn't until 2010, for example, at U of M that students got the option to check more than one box. Do you see a day when it will be nothing to even think twice about?
Well, I'll say that some of my readers will tell me that day has already arrived. And they'll say, well, this is no news. And I'm a historian, and so I appreciate that in some sense the fact of people of what we would call mixed race has always been a feature of the United States, its demographics, and its culture. We had different terms for mixed race people in the 19th century United States when the census permitted respondents to be identified as mulattoes,
yes,
or quadroons.
Yes.
So there's an older history here, and I take the reader's point that this is part of a much longer story in some sense. At the same time, I think for the first time, our questions are about the experience, the contributions to diversity, and the political situatedness of mixed race people are still open questions for us in 2014.
Martha, when you had that moment, as you described in that seminar class in 2010, when you hear so many students say, "Oh, I'm mixed race. I'm from a mixed race family," and you found yourself saying, "Me too," was that liberating for you, or was it unsettling to have to find yourself stepping away from the black identification you'd lived with your whole life?
The truth is, it was terrifying, which is to say, the stakes in identity and race and identity in the United States are oftentimes huge, personally, politically, and socially. And so I recognized in that moment that I was stepping outside of my box, if you will. And for many of us, that's a moment of great discomfort. At the same time, I am a teacher. And part of the reason I'm a teacher is because I know that in my classrooms, over my lifetime, I will continue to learn and my ideas will change, and that oftentimes the changes in my own ideas and insights come by way of my students. It's one of the great gifts in the life of a professor. So it was an exciting moment at the same time, because I thought, now these young people have opened up an area of inquiry, a set of questions about myself personally, but also opened up new avenues for research and writing.
Martha S. Jones is an associate professor of history, law, Afro-American, and African studies at the University of Michigan. Her piece in the Huffington Post is entitled, "When It Comes to Diversity, Who Counts?" Thank you so much for sharing your story and your thoughts with us today on Stateside, Martha.
Thank you, Cynthia.
With winter finally behind us, we hope, fruit farmers all over Michigan are now getting an idea of what the snow, ice, and cold has done to their orchards, vineyards, and fields. Well, knowing that the early spring warm-up of 2012 was devastating to most of Michigan's fruit growers, we wondered if this rough winter has them just as worried now as they were 2 years ago. We're joined now by Ken Nye of the Michigan Farm Bureau. So good to have you with us, Ken.
Well, it's great to be here.
So do you believe fruit farmers are in danger of any kind of a repeat of 2012?
Well, we certainly hope not. 2012 was certainly a bit of an unusual situation where we had this big warm-up in March, early March, and then by the end of the month, we started experiencing a string of frost events, which is pretty normal this time of year,
yeah.
And into April. But the problem is we had warmed up so much earlier in March, and we had gotten the fruit crops in a very vulnerable condition in terms of the buds and the blooming and so on. The 2014, the winter was obviously pretty brutal, and the problem that we're experiencing now is just the cold temperatures that we really experienced throughout January, February, and March. So we're dealing with that now, trying to assess exactly what the situation is, but we know we've got some damage out there.
What kind of damage? What are you seeing and hearing from fruit growers?
Well, most of the fruit is grown on the west side of the state, although there's pockets of production in other areas. One of the advantages we have here in Michigan is our climate that we have, particularly moderated by Lake Michigan. So it allows us to grow all these fruit crops that don't necessarily grow everywhere. So this year we had a lot of temperatures that were down to minus 20 degrees, and any time we get that, we're going to start to reduce the number of viable buds on any of our more tender fruit crops, and that's going to include wine grapes, peaches, cherries, apricots, the blueberries. Apples and pears are a little hardier, tend to be able to grow in little colder locations, but all of those other more tender crops are going to see some damage in terms of we've killed off a number of the buds at this point, or perhaps we've even damaged the branches, limbs, and even whole trees. When we get minus 20, it's pretty tough on certain peach varieties. The wine grapes, I'm afraid we're going to have potentially significant damage.
Hmm.
So it's a concern to us. We're going to learn more as we get into a little more of the spring here, but we know we've got a problem already.
Well, now, Ken, we heard that the heavy snowfall was a good thing in a sense because it added it's going to be adding badly needed moisture to ground and surface water reserves. So is that true?
Well, it does. The moisture in that snow was a good thing in terms of adding that moisture. And we saw a pretty good spring in terms of most of that snow melting off and really absorbing as much as possible. Even though it was really cold this winter, because we had so much snow cover, we didn't have much frost in the ground. So most of that was able to soak in. So that's a good thing. Now, for the fruit trees, the snow is a plus and a minus. It does insulate, and particularly for wine grapes and any of the grapes, it will insulate the buds that are below the frost, below the snow line, so that's a good thing. On the bad side, occasionally when that snow or the ice goes away, it does pull a few branches with it.
Mm.
That can be a bad thing. And the other thing, as long and as cold and as much snow as there was this winter, we saw quite a bit of rodent damage on trunks and branches and so on, and the snow really created an environment where those mice, rabbits, and so on had to live, obviously, in some pretty brutal conditions for a long time, and they're going to tend to eat some of that bark and so on off from the fruit trees, so that's going to be a problem, too.
I bet the deer were busy, too, because I know I've seen them in our backyard, and they were hungry.
Absolutely. When you have winter like this, a lot of their brows might have been covered up, so they're going to keep eating whatever they can find above the snow line.
I also got a sense that that having the counties having to put so much salt on the roads could also impact our fruit crop.
Well, it does, and we found that over the years, blueberry plantations. You know, we're the largest blueberry producing state. The salt from the roads used to reduce the ice and snow on the roads will damage the buds on blueberries. It just, as you'd think, salt dries things out. As that bud dries out, it becomes more vulnerable to the cold weather. We had lots of ice, lots of snow this year, so even more salt was used. And we had this really cold temperature, so when you combine all those things together, we're going to see quite a bit of damage to the blueberry buds. Now, fortunately, most fruit crops tend to produce more buds than are necessary.
Mm.
So we're going to see how we get through the rest of the spring here. If we don't have frost events, maybe we'll still be able to come through with a reasonably good crop. But we know we've already reduced the number of viable buds, in some cases pretty significantly. We got to have some good luck here for the next 4 to 6 weeks so we can get through the rest of the spring.
Ken Nye with the Michigan Farm Bureau. Thanks so much for talking with us, Ken.
It was great to be here.
Welcome back to Stateside. For the past 35 years, Hockey Town in Detroit has meant the Joe Louis Arena on Detroit's riverfront. But the Joe's days as the home of the Detroit Red Wings are numbered. The Wings are headed north to the Cass Corridor area between downtown Detroit and Midtown. A new $450 million 18,000-seat arena is on the way for Wings owner Mike Ilitch, perhaps as early as the 2016-2017 season. What is drawing fire from critics like my next guest is the fact that the stadium deal has the public covering nearly 60% of the sticker price, the Ilitches getting all the revenues from the new stadium, and the whole deal was unveiled publicly the week after Detroit declared bankruptcy. Bill Bradley is a columnist at Next City, where he covers economic development in cities. He dug into the new Wings Arena in a piece for nextcity.org. Its title, Red Wing Stadium Upset, Why Taxpayers Are Losing Again in Detroit. Welcome to Stateside, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
And we should establish, if we will, your street cred as as a Michigander. You grew up here and you went to Western?
Yeah, and I'm, despite what critics of the piece think, I am a diehard Tigers and Red Wings fan.
So you're very familiar with all of the nuances of this complicated story about the new home for the Red Wings. What was it about this arrangement for the Wings Arena that really drew your attention? Was it the timing coming right after the bankruptcy?
I mean, it was just the gross misuse of taxpayer dollars. I think the timing of the bankruptcy obviously makes it the optics a little bit worse, but it was just this isn't just Mike Ilitch. This happens everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it made it seem a whole lot worse because the city had just declared for bankruptcy.
So as we look at who's paying how much for this new home for the Wings, we know that the arena is going to be $450 million. Olympia is picking up 42% of the construction cost, and the public's share is 58%. And then there's going to be another $200 million for all the development expected to spring up around the arena. Can you help us understand the financing arrangement?
Yeah, so if you look at it, it's a tax increment financing. You know, there's so many acronyms in the article.
Yeah.
And tax increment financing essentially freezes the property taxes in that footprint, that arena footprint, in the TIF district, as it's called. And then any increases in property taxes or property value are then poured into the development. So that's what is going to pay back part of the bonds.
Okay. We know it uses school and local property tax revenue collected
yes.
by the DDA, Detroit's Downtown Development Authority, to pay off state-issued bonds. Yeah?
So the bonds are issued by the Michigan Strategic Fund. Detroit is bankrupt, so the city can't issue bonds. They're
right.
issued by the Michigan Strategic Fund, which is Michigan's economic development agency. And they're backed by three different revenue streams. Ilitch, Olympia Entertainment, is paying 11.5, or Olympia Development is paying $11.5 million annually
mm-hmm.
over the next 30 years. Then the DDA TIF is paying a minimum of $12.8 million and a maximum of $15 million over the next 30 years. So that will come from that tax increment financing district. So, like I said, the property taxes will be frozen when the TIF starts.
Okay.
And so the idea is that this arena will increase property value. And rather than have those increase in property taxes go into the city's general fund, it will go into the TIF fund, which will then pay back the bonds. And then there's an additional $2.15 million from various tax captures through Wayne county. It's worth mentioning, too, that they're tax-exempt bonds.
And as you point out in your piece for Next City, the DDA, Detroit Downtown Development Authority, insists there is no difference to a student in Detroit Public Schools whether that money is refunding bonds or going directly into the DPS budget because the state is making up the shortfalls. And as you say, isn't something taking a hit somewhere?
Yeah, essentially, I mean, it is $12.8 million from the taxpayers. No matter how you cut it, it's taxpayer money.
You point out in your piece, too, a bottom line, even as the city of Detroit's mired in bankruptcy and all the hardships that entails for pensioners and residents and city employees, there's still $284.5 million for a new hockey arena.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. People say, well, you know, it'll bring people downtown. I mean, there's just a better way to use public money. So that TIF district, they could use it for, I asked Brian Holdwick at the Detroit Economic Growth Corporation, I said, what about small business loans or affordable housing? And, you know, they used a line that lawmakers have used time and again, and they say, well, we had a willing partner. Basically, they said Mike Ilitch was willing to put up this money. Now that entire TIF for the next 30 years is dedicated only to the arena deal, as opposed to slicing it up and, you know, dedicating it to various projects. It's all lumped in for the new Red Wings arena.
I'm speaking with Bill Bradley, who's a columnist at Next City, and he wrote a big piece at nextcity.org entitled Red Wings Stadium Upset, Why Taxpayers Are Losing Again in Detroit. Bill, take us through the acquisition of the land for the new Wings Arena. And there's been a buzz going on for a number of years that the Ilitches have been quietly buying up lots. So I take it from that some landowners have made some money on this, yes?
Yes. Yeah, so, like, for example, there's a market on the corner of Park and Sibley in that area that got $5 million. The Free Press did a rundown, an analysis of all the various plots of land that were bought by Olympia for hefty price tags, and then the remaining 39 parcels were sold to the DDA for $1.
And once this arena is built, Olympia, meaning the Ilitches, will get all of the revenue, yes?
Yeah, so right now at Joe Louis, there's an agreement where the city gets, I think, roughly $7 million in annual revenue. The new deal, they get no revenue, no rent, and no property taxes.
And we've learned that once the Wings leave the Joe, the city of Detroit has a no-compete clause with Olympia, so it's not allowed to hold any ticketed events at the Joe before it's torn down, which, by the way, will be paid for by the state, which will also make a $5.2 million payment for any unpaid bills due to the city of Detroit under the Wings' previous lease. So I just am wondering, Bill, is all of this typical, or are we seeing both the state of Michigan and the city of Detroit really, really bending over backward to accommodate Mike Ilitch?
You know, the piece does sort of make Mike Ilitch out to be a villain, but he's just doing what every other sports owner in America has done before him and continues to do.
Sure.
This is typical. This is not an outlier by any means. In fact, some cities have given sports owners even sweeter deals.
Why do you think that appetite is there?
I mean, who wants to be the mayor or the city council president when the Red Wings say, all right, well, we're going to move to the suburbs, or even worse, we're going to move to another city? But in the piece I examined, when Seattle's NBA team, the Supersonics, left town, the guy, Nick Licata, the council member who was the sort of leading voice on legislation that limited public subsidies, he didn't lose his seat, even though the Sonics left Seattle for Oklahoma City. So there is this fear that you'll get run out of town because the favorite sports team left on your watch, but that's never really happened. Anecdotally, at least.
Okay. I'm wondering, as you examine stadium deals and arena deals around the nation, has it lived up to the promise?
No. I mean, that's the thing. You know, people have made it their life's work to fight against this. And study after study shows that phrase that gets thrown around a lot, economic impact, just isn't there. Because all the revenues line the owner's pockets.
And when you talk about jobs, and when you think about it, the guy who is going up and down the aisle with the beer cart or selling Cracker Jack is not making big money. So we aren't talking about a lot of high-paying jobs when we look at concessions and parking and maintenance, which is the kind of jobs that will exist after the construction, yes?
Yeah, and they're part-time, low-paying jobs. And another problem, this is why City Council President Brenda Jones voted against the land transfer deal. Olympia refused to guarantee a certain number of post-construction jobs to Detroiters. Mm. So they had asked for an agreement, a binding agreement, that would say you need to give a certain percentage of these post-construction jobs, so the jobs in the arena once it's open, to tax-paying Detroiters, not to someone from Warren, not to someone from the suburbs, people who live within the city limits. And Olympia has refused to agree to that. And now it's worth mentioning that there are going to be more jobs. They say there's going to be 500 more jobs at the new arena than there are at the Joe. But is that really a net gain when you think of the amount of money that's being poured into this?
And you know, and you've heard from them, you know there are a lot of voices, you've alluded to this, that who are going to say, well, keep the Wings in Detroit and we'll have the Lions and the Tigers and Wings all together in the same general area, and it will prompt more life and development into an area that, you know, admittedly was extremely bleak. There hasn't been a lot there. And to that you say?
Well, part of the reason there hasn't been anything in the Cass Corridor is because people have been speculating quietly for years that that's where the Illiches wanted to put the Wings. Mm. And so it stunted any sort of development that would have gone on there. And now it's also worth mentioning here that, yeah, the Lower Cass Corridor is pretty bleak and pretty dead. So this could breathe some life into it, but on game nights, you know what I mean? Is it going to – there's 41 home games a year plus however many concerts. Is that really going to – you know, completely change the face of the neighborhood? Go around Comerica Park on a Tuesday night in December or on a Wednesday night when the Tigers are in Chicago. It's not that lively.
So what could the city have done to get a better deal, and it maybe something that's worked in another city?
Yeah, well, there really hasn't been anything that has worked in another city, sadly. But what I wrote about in the piece was last August, 2013, City of Orlando got a Major League Soccer team. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they needed a new stadium. And a county commissioner proposed a deal that said, all right, we'll give you $20 million to fund your new stadium, but the taxpayers get an equity stake in the team. And, of course, they balked at that and nothing happened. But that sort of model is what progressives think makes sense. Okay, we'll foot the bill, we'll help here, but give the taxpayers a stake. And it's not a model like Green Bay.
Okay.
Where the owners are stockholders in the city. But if we're going to give you $284.5 million, we want some of the revenues. We want a stake in the team because you can pick up and leave whenever you want. And we're going to be left with this arena. Another thing that I didn't mention is Olympia gets all the money from the naming rights for
That's
whoever...
Right.
You know, Comerica or Ford Field, whoever the arena is named after, they get that, which could be upwards of $60 million.
There's another big chunk of money in the piggy bank. And, you know, just as you talk about who's stuck with the stadium or the arena if the team ups and moves, ask the city of Pontiac. It's had that big white elephant called the Silver Dome for a long time, hanging, twisting in the wind out there at Updike and M59. You know, aside from the financials and the politicals, do you think the Red Wings did need a new arena? Has the Joe seen its day?
I mean, I love the Joe. You know, it's this sort of charming dump.
But it's our dump.
Yeah, it's our dump, exactly. But when compared to other arenas, yeah, they probably need some more bathrooms. They could certainly use handrails and new seats. And I won't deny that from a planning perspective, it makes sense to put it in the Lower Cass Corridor as opposed to along the river in a sort of wasteland. I mean, it will bring more people into the city 41 nights a year. But that does not justify it as an engine of economic development or growth.
But we probably should comment, too, like Detroit City Councilman Gabe Leland pointed out, tearing down that big kind of anonymous hulk, as he said, this is not one of my favorite buildings in Detroit. So tearing down the Joe could offer new opportunities to make better use of that riverfront.
Yeah, and the Riverfront Conservancy has done a terrific job extending the path and cleaning it up all the way down to the De Quinter Cut.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that this will allow them to continue that path.
Bill Bradley's a columnist at Next City, and you can find his piece, Red Wing Stadium Upset, Why Taxpayers Are Losing Again in Detroit, at nextcity.org. Bill, it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's end today's show with a fun fact. For 125 years, a Michigan business has been manufacturing workers' clothing. That Michigan-made company is Carhartt.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
Today, Carhartt is known for its durable work clothing. However, when the company's founder, Hamilton Carhartt, made his first pair of overalls, he failed. Mark Vallade, Hamilton Carhartt's great-grandson and Carhartt's current CEO, explains the company's beginnings.
My great-grandfather was a horse and wagon salesman traveling around southern Michigan, and he noted that the overalls that most people were wearing, especially with the railroad industry, they were homemade from scraps that were found around the house or at the local general store. So he thought he could make a better overall.
Wow.
And so what he did is he bought some scraps of denim, and he put the what he thought was the best pair of overalls together, and he went out and tried to have a few people try them on and whatever, and they didn't like it. So basically, his first try at overalls, he failed. This is back in 1889.
What did he do to make it more palatable, make it more appealing?
He contacted a railroad engineer, talked to this engineer, and engineer told him exactly how to make it more functional, and he produced a pair that was very successful after that. What he did is that he was a natural salesman, and so he had these overalls, and on his on his horse and wagon travels, still selling other products, he would stop in the local town and talk to the engineers and railroad workers and tell them about this great product that he had. And he said, you know, I'm going to be going over to the local general store, and would you stop by and just say, I looked at these Carhartt overalls, and as you said, quote unquote, cheer for me. And so he would, you know, slowly build up his distribution in southern Michigan, and then kind of grew from there.
And that was the late 19th century. Here we are in 2014, and you're still here in Michigan. There was not a... Still based in Michigan?
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, it's more or less tradition. We love the people here, and so we've never had an issue out of the 125 years of employment.
Somehow, one must think that Hamilton would be very, very pleased to know that his great-grandson is carrying on the tradition in Michigan.
I'm not sure if that is the case, but I would hope so.
And that was Mark Vallade of Carhartt. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.